What's up, folks? Hope you're doing well. I am here with my friend, my boy, former podcast co-host Jeremy Johnson. And Jeremy, for those who are from the liminal web, needs no introduction. He's a philosopher specializing in the theory of Gene Gebser, host of the Mutations podcast, and now getting your PhD from CIS, I understand?
That's right. Yep. Yeah. Good to be here, Ryan.
And what is your PhD in?
Philosophy, cosmology, and consciousness, or technically it's a doctorate in the philosophy of religion, but that's the name of the program, PCC. Yeah.
Gotcha. Awesome. Well, Jeremy, it's great to be with you again. It kind of reminds me of some of our growing down podcast days, and it's kind of a nice reunion, micro reunion. So welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here. And like you were just saying, I am getting kind of reminiscent vibes of growing down. Many of the conversations we've been having outside of our recording have been very growing down oriented, just sort of the meta commentary on the politics of our integral communities or liminal communities, et cetera. So it was only a matter of time, I feel, until we jumped on and recorded something. So yeah, good to be here.
Where do we begin? Because, you know, your Discord group is a funny, you know, place. I love just kind of venting there and kind of letting my worst, most polarizing, obnoxious self be on full display in a kind of humorous way. And I think I'm genuinely, along with other people, they're processing some critiques or frustrations or differences of opinion with, I don't know what you'd call the mainstream liminal web guys and thought leaders and luminaries in the community. And you know, Jordan Hall had posted something on Twitter about ideology and using the bifurcation of ideological versus non-ideological as a maybe more helpful framework than the left-right spectrum. And I completely disagree. My entire show is based on a disagreement with that. So, you know, we all got kind of fired up and we're kind of firing off different texts in that Discord group. So I was just wondering, yeah, I kind of wanted to open it up and really see, you know, where you're coming in from, kind of your critique. And, you know, we've talked about this before, but it keeps coming up again and again. So I thought, let's just process it out loud in a recording, put it out there, see what happens, get some critiques from the audience. And then we'll kind of unfold it, and then we'll kind of see our contrast our differences or differences in emphasis in our approaches and kind of internalize that critique into this conversation. So I think it'll be fun. But yeah, just opening it up, like, how are you thinking about it? What have been some salient or significant themes for you in this kind of critique of the sense-making sphere?
Yeah. So you mentioned that tweet from Jordan Hall, and it seems like Jordan Hall's tweets tend to be catalysts for these sorts of discussions in our communities. nothing, you know, we're not going after Hall particularly, but I think Hall's articulation of our frustrations with the liminal web or the sort of meta-modern alternative communities as a whole, he's really good at articulating what those problems are and getting like a kind of very strong statement that we can now respond to, right? And I found it interesting that both you and Jason Snyder, who's kind of the meta-modern doomer optimist, was also responding in a very interesting way. But yeah, he made that post about how left and right ideology as a sort of framework isn't helpful, and he prefers to use ideological versus non-ideological as a kind of framing. And as you said, right, there's no way out of ideology. And this is something that I think the left is far more familiar with, like our terminology, what we mean by ideology is, well, everybody's sort of baked into ideology, right? It's more about becoming aware of what those frameworks are and not perhaps using them poorly, right? Doubling down, being inflexible, seeing them in a completely totalizing way. So having some degree of fluidity, and to borrow an integral term, if I dare move into like integral theory territory, like almost a construct aware usage of our own ideology, I think is what the left tends to promote, not always successfully, obviously, but ideology can be used constructively, it can be used rigidly. It's more about an awareness of it rather than being non-ideological. I think being non-ideological is a very dangerous kind of statement. It's a kind of bypassing of ideology itself to presume that we are non-ideological because we proclaim that we don't like the negative or extreme versions of ideology online is really to not look at ourselves, right? To not see how we're actually enacting it. And we see this, I think, again and again and again in the liminal web, where there's claims to be non-ideological or post-ideological, And then the kinds of claims that they make after that statement tend to be very ideological, particularly centrist or conservative or libertarian. And that's fine. Like, we can enter that realm of debate about our positions, but just not being able to identify where we're coming from because we believe we're non-ideological it's difficult to have a conversation with someone who is claiming that. So that kind of, I sense your response was touching on that. And also Jason Snyder's response was touching on that when he was talking basically about like non-ideological is probably not the most useful way of framing things, right? And what we're looking for is not non-ideological versus ideological, but that fluidity or perspective taking or flexibility, right? That's a good indication of somebody who's not as rigid in their ideological leanings and is capable of perspective taking as a more helpful heuristic for us in the sphere of debate and politics, et cetera. So yeah, how about you? What's your sense
you articulated my program better than I could myself. Yeah. Yeah, it was beautiful. I mean, and yeah, I love Jason Snyder's replies in that tweet. I mean, he nailed it. I agree with everything that he said. So you know how Hanzi talks about this concept of developmental blindness? That's kind of his core themes in his Metamodern series. It's just like this idea that development is always there, but you know, we haven't really seen its scaffoldings as a culture because we can't really conceptualize it, right? So instead of out of sight, out of mind, it's out of mind, out of sight kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. My critique of the liminal web in general is what I call ideological blindness. People don't really see that their positions when it comes to politics are highly ideological and politicized. And the dominant frameworks, the dominant analytic frameworks through which we use to make sense of complex systemic dynamics, right? Complexity theory, game theory, a la game B and so forth, right? Systems theory, thinking about feedback loops and interconnections and path dependence and attractors and blah, blah, blah. All these concepts, which I use a lot and find very helpful and find a lot of resonance with them, ever deepening my understanding of. But I don't think that, you know, especially when it comes to how we're socialized in this hyper-politicized, hyper-polarized political climate, we cannot just pretend like those frameworks will supplant conventional political ideological framings, right? Thinking about mm-hmm. conservatism, libertarianism, classical liberalism, social justice, and identity politics, right? These are all frames that still enter into the picture. And so when someone says, oh, I'm beyond all of that, and I'm seeing reality in this kind of, in a new, sexier, you know, more refined sense-making lenses or frameworks, that completely bypass the political realm altogether and bypass ideology, that leads to the unintended consequence of that is leading to more polarization because we can't be transparent about our politicized political mm-hmm. leanings. Maybe one day we could, but in today's polarized climate, my contention is that we can't, and that does more of a disservice to dialogue than really actually being able to bridge divides or find common ground or converge towards shared interventions, right? So, that's kind of where I'm coming from and hopefully promoting more political and ideological literacy. There's an entire field in political science called ideology studies. One of the most prominent scholars in the field is named Michael Frieden. He's a British professor. Really excellent work, you know, studying like what is ideology, right? And what's one of the things I find very ironic is if you look into the history of ideology, the intellectual history of ideology, the term was first used by a French philosopher who was imprisoned during the Reign of Terror in France in 1796, named Antoine de Tracy. And ideology really means, per the word, the science of ideas, right? It's ology and idea. So it's the science of ideas, right? Its first incarnations as a pejorative use were actually from Napoleon Bonaparte, who criticized his enemies as being ideologues. And then that was really adopted by Marx and Engels, right? Ideology is a kind of brainwashed false consciousness from the dominant capitalist system through workers cannot understand how they're being oppressed. And so the dominant capitalist ideology was something that needed to be dispelled via critical consciousness. So it's very ironic that a lot of people who are more conservative leaning, who have a very negative connotation or negatively weaponize or use ideology as a pejorative, the guys who really popularized that angle was Karl Marx, right? So when Jordan Peterson was like, abandon ideology because ideology is bad, I'm like, well, who's the cultural neo-Marxist now, Jordan? Like, the hell is a Marxist who really kind of popularized it as a pejorative, as a you know, attack on being a fundamentalist, you know, overly rigid, dogmatic, right? This Procrustean bed of ideology that destroys complexity, right? So the idea of meta-ideology is, well, we can't get away from ideology, but we can be construct aware, we can use it as a tool, we can use it to develop this our kind of sense-making architecture, and let's use it consciously, and let's draw from a wide range of them so that we can see things that we would have otherwise missed or overlooked had we abandoned ideology and returned mm-hmm. to what exactly? Like, there's mm-hmm. always going to be some epistemic dimension to our to how we view the world. So to pretend like we're seeing reality as it is, unmediated by some kind of framework, to me is just, A, it's just not true. And mm-hmm. B, it can destroy conversation and productive dialogue. So ideological honesty, self-awareness, and transparency. What are our biases? What are the frames we're coming from? And then let's move the conversation forward. So that's kind of like mm-hmm. what this project mm-hmm. is really all about, and specifically as a way to combat polarization.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that sounds like a great foundation. And I'm somewhat familiar with it from our previous conversations, obviously, but that's kind of the problem when we enter these spaces where there's a deliberate kind of attempt to abandon ideology, but then reify particular forms of ideology without really looking at them, right? And that was part of your comment in our notes leading up to our conversation about how I think the conservative view is to sort of naturalize certain things, right? To ontologize, let's say, the structures of power in our society or hierarchies, right? And this is sort of Wilbur's framing about dominator hierarchies versus natural hierarchies. It's never that easy to distinguish the two, because very often they're conflated. And I think Peterson does that all the time in terms of claiming, you know, let's say a particular social hierarchy is actually a natural hierarchy, and it's perfectly fine. It's not a dominator one, or it doesn't have to be as dominator because it's just there. It's part of nature. We're lobsters, or something along the lines of the way evolution works, right? So there's this attempt to naturalize ideology, right? And that's the problem, right? When we're not aware of doing that, that becomes an issue. There's nothing wrong with ontology, and as we were talking about, sort of the underlying structures, let's say phenomenology, ontology, the structure of feeling of a society, right? And the times that we are in certainly feed into our ideological leanings, and they help construct ideology. But it's difficult to kind of put a discrete finger on exactly what ontology is, whereas I think it's a bit easier, and it lends itself to deconstruction and historicity to kind of understand the production of an idea, right? The production of an ideology, its emergence in society, its historical influences, right? You can kind of trace all of those material influences and go, okay, here is how this type of thinking was produced in late 18th century France, et cetera, et cetera. It's harder to do that, I feel, with ontology at this deeper level, maybe like what we're talking about with like worldview construction or structures of consciousness, right? So there's a lot underneath the surface that epistemology, ideology still get mixed into. They're coming with us anyway as we move into ontology and talk about those deeper questions. But if we're not aware of ideology as we enter that discourse, then we end up reproducing a lot of these same problems that like Peterson does with his thinking and his writing, right? In terms of being post-ideological or non-ideological. And I think Wilbur does the same as well, as in terms of reifying certain natural dominator hierarchies as natural ones, right? There's some ideological leanings in there as well. So I don't know if that'll make sense, but that's kind of the move I see that tends to happen with the IDW in terms of moving from shunning ideology and trying to embrace ontology or natural hierarchy. And the left, I feel, is much more comfortable with the language of being aware of how ideology is constructed historically, et cetera. So there's also kind of like an immunology here as well. There's like tendencies for the right to be more comfortable with the talking about nature and being, et cetera, and spirituality, which is another problem. And then the left being more comfortable with these kinds of secular constructions of knowledge and history and identity, et cetera, which is also very true, right? So I don't know where I'm going with this other than sort of mapping it out with you a little bit.
Oh, beautiful. So this is the way I've been thinking about it. And obviously this is a oversimplification, but I think it's kind of a fun way to frame it. I think the critical theory postmodernist left, what they're doing is trying to take falsely naturalized ontologies and turn them into epistemology. You're saying, no, this is a product of false consciousness. Your conception of reality and naturalizing these aspects of the system as such, it's actually not the way it really is, nor is it the way that it has to be. These are arbitrarily constructed constructs that are, you know, engendered and solidified through the dominant power structures and discourses in society. So you're seeing something and believing something to be real when it's really not. It's really just mm-hmm. a bias that you have internalized and imbibed unconsciously. Mm-hmm. And so you epistemologize the false ontology. The right, what the right's counter reaction to the left's game denial, shall we say, right, is to say, hey, your ideologies are delusional constructs that are dissociated from the true ontological ground of reality. And that kind of those abstractions, these unnatural abstractions that don't map onto reality, do violence to this sacred ontological ground that you guys are violating with your gender theory and identity politics and so forth, right? So you are actually have false reifications. So we need to transform epistemology into a real ontology. So that's mm-hmm. kind of how I've been, another way of thinking philosophically about the cultural divide and polarization in this country. And so I can kind of go both ways, but again, my bias as being more on the left is that for whatever reason, not in a partisan or political sense, but more just that I'm more comfortable with epistemology, because to me, it's like, it's easier to then valorize epistemic humility, mm-hmm. right? Having mm-hmm. open-mindedness, as you were saying, this fluid perspective taking, empathy taking, et cetera. When we lean on epistemology, I feel like that can be a more direct link to having epistemic humility. Whereas when we talk about ontology, the part of me that does depolarization mediation work can get a little uncomfortable, because I'm like, well, are you sure that that's how reality really is, right? Are you sure that's the way? And then my concern is that leads to a kind of fundamentalism that can't be disrupted. But mm-hmm. I would like to challenge myself and get more comfortable talking about ontology, because it's always there. You can't, it's kind of like ideology. You can't get away from some notion of what you think the underlying structure of reality is. So I've been looking at that myself, and but I still don't, I haven't really fleshed that out as it relates to meta ideological politics, since the word is so epistemologically focused. So that's mm-hmm. why I thought, oh, Jeremy is like the ontology guy and phenomenology too. And I thought you could kind of challenge me and help me, you know, develop that more, so that all of us from whatever position we are just have a more holistic and complete avenue into all of these questions.
Yeah. I think, you know, again, with Gebser, or with, let's say, a lot of our traditions of counterculture, right? Like either the Ken Wilbers of the world, or the William Ruin Thompsons, or the Gene Gebsers, or the plethora of new scholarship around integral evolution of consciousness, et cetera. Folks that are looking at worldviews, they're really not just looking at epistemology, although epistemes are used, like Lene Rachel Anderson's work on metamodernism, right? She has the different epistemes, and they're the ones we're familiar with, pre-modern, right? Or tradition, was it pre-modern or traditional, modern, postmodern, right? And then there's metamodern. So there's a framing of it as a way of knowing, right? Which is true, but there's this other aspect, I think, that we have to keep in mind, which is the ontological, or like, how is it to be in the world? What is the universe, right? These are more fundamental structures that are not exactly the kind of ontology that we're thinking of when we say, oh, we'll naturalize hierarchy. It's certainly a part of it, but I think it's even a more fundamental stance that has deeper roots in the evolution of different cultures, right? And require a kind of gestalt description, like worldview or structure of consciousness, more so than even ontology. Although I use ontology more openly, because I think it's good to get in touch with how does it feel to be in the world? What is the world like in terms of our relationship with the cosmos, right? What is the universe? Not just how do we know the universe, but what is it to be, right? And I think for Westerners and Western European thinkers, thinking and being have that intimate connection, and has been for quite some time. We're talking about the birth of modernity, right? The birth of all of these different forms of knowledge, even ideology as a science of knowing, right? There is not just an ideological approach, but a way of being that helps construct the way we think, the organization of what McLuhan describes as our sense ratios, right? Our experiential dimensions in terms of how we encounter time, how we are in relationship to our environment, in relationship to other people, right? Ideology feeds into all of that, obviously, but underneath it, I think, is this ontological question about how are we being in the world, and how are we being with the world and with each other? And those questions of being are very difficult. And again, there's like layers even to ontology, where there's the kind of shifting ontologies of, I don't know, naturalizing hierarchy, or saying that, okay, well, women are this and men are that and gender is this, right? It's always been this way. Those are the kind of surface level, perhaps. And then we have to trace a bit deeper down into more of the phenomenological or the structures of consciousness to kind of get into the construction of ontologies in some ways is what I'm more interested in terms of my own work with Gebser. And that ties to phenomenology, of course, because the way in is very often trying to experience itself. What is it to be in a Cartesian worldview, right? What is it to actually be in that? What does it feel like? What kind of art does it produce? And what can our aesthetics and modes of thinking tell us about that relationship between subject and object, self and world, et cetera, self and universe? So those are deeper worldview oriented questions, but I think they're really profoundly important to consider when we fold that back into questions of ideological political leanings and how do we understand ourselves in relationship to government and society? And is there such a thing as progress? Like, do we affirm the kind of modernist liberties, right? The kind of the whole civilizational framework we've developed over the past 500 years has certain ontological worldview and phenomenological leanings, right? That have to kind of be understood in order to really comment on the superstructure and the complexity that's going on today, right? There's complexity below and there's complexity above, perhaps, might be a way to put it. So I kind of see them in that sort of relationship. For Gebser, it's getting to the roots, right? It's really about getting to the roots, tracing ontology, tracing the transformations of ontology, and then using cultural phenomenology to study that, whether it's looking at art or a philosopher, the way they think, et cetera. The way a painter paints and the way a philosopher thinks are both cultural phenomenology in that sense, looking at the underlying structure of consciousness or ontological relationship. And to give like a more concrete example, because maybe we can't see modernist ontology or mental structure ontology, as Gebser calls, as easily, as McLuhan understands, like it's hard to see the sea that you're swimming in, right? You're just in the medium and becomes invisible. There's a lot of folks talking about ecological ontology today, right? Like being ecological, like Timothy Morton talks about, right? That there's a fundamental complexity to being and stickiness to being, right? Relationship between self and other and world is intrinsically irreducible, interrelated, and kind of messy. And if that's our fundamental understanding, not fundamental understanding, but if that is the way it feels to be ecological, then we have to go into that too. And we have to consider how that is changing our epistemics, right? Changing the ways that we are thinking, transforming our social imaginaries, et cetera. So I find ontology to be a very good inquiry, but you have to kind of dig deep into almost the civilizational ontology to get to this level of discourse, I suppose. Does that all make sense?
Yeah, that's really interesting. You know, it reminds me a little bit of kind of starting inspiration for MIP, which was my conversations with Bruce Alderman on integral post-metaphysical spirituality, right? And part of that, you know, again, it kind of is similar to like the ideology thing of like post-metaphysical. Can you really be post-metaphysical, right? Is post-metaphysics itself not a metaphysical statement? But the idea that he describes so well, right, is understanding that there are competing ontological descriptions of reality, right? There are competing ontologies, and part of, you know, the dissatisfaction of boxing yourself into like, I have to be a I don't know, realist or idealist or emergentist or materialist, right? It's like, we don't want to like box ourselves into one, right? Or say, oh, you know, or posit a kind of Cartesian subject-object dualism that might be indicative of an antiquated modernist paradigm. So how do we encourage this kind of fluidity in everything you're saying? Well, it's about doing kind of ontological self-experiments by putting yourself as deeply as you can into this ontological world space and then monitoring how that subjectively and phenomenologically impacts you, right? What is the phenomenological experience of this kind of ontological immersion? And then, to use Bruce Alderman's term, right, you're kind of kaleidoscopically cycling through them and really feeling those feeling structures that accompany these ontological dimensions, right, that you're immersing yourself in. And so I said, well, let's try that with political ideology too, right? Like, what does it really feel like to truly immerse yourself in a Marxist worldview, a Marxist paradigm, right? In a social justice kind of paradigm, in a libertarian, you know, anti-government or anarchist paradigm. in a traditional conservative one, right? In a modern classical liberal one, right? And like really kind of feeling the ontological dimensions and also the, you know, the emotional valences, right? The value structures that accompany these ideologies, and also understanding key ideas, you know, at the ideational level, right? Theoretically and philosophically. And then kind of rotating through them. And so one exercise that I do is I'll drive, when I'm driving my car to the gym, I'll just like, okay, I'm going to think of everything through Marxism. I'm just going to drive by like all the people I see, the buildings. I'm just going to put like force that lens on, see what it does internally, then switch it to like anarchism, then switch it to conservatism, switch it to libertarianism, and really like immerse myself. And I found this to be a very practical exercise in two reasons, right? One, for my own development as a person, continually breaking my frame or dominant point of reference. It illuminates all of my biases and blind spots, and I can see reality more holistically and more in its totality, right? So there's a personal growth and personal development aspect of doing this exercise. The second part is it's really helped me in my work in mediation and depolarization, because by cultivating that pattern of feeling via ideology before I talk to someone of a radically different perspective, there's already a pre-established bridge for resonance there that I built or cultivated in myself before the conversation. So when I do have that conversation, it's easier for me to just get into that space. And I may get into that space in a different way, in a slightly different way than that person feels, because we'll never feel the same thing 100%, especially when they're diametrically opposed to everything they believe in. But there's still that connection, that bridge can still be built. Right. So it's a way for me to also prepare for difficult conversations, or when two parties are in conflict, I can kind of hold both of them, and it's easier for me to feel into them and not be biased towards one side or the other. Right. So I found a lot of interpersonal and community building pragmatism with this kind of exercise. But it's still kind of like, well, there's the phenomenological aspect of it. Right. There's the theoretical and ideational part of it, understanding, steel manning these ideologies, but ontologically there are a lot of competing claims in there too, and I still haven't figured out where I landed, other than just ontologically starting from just the assumption that reality is irreducibly complex into any one thought system, and then phenomenologically kind of like the Buddhist idea of emptiness, right? That there's a kind of emptiness that can hold all of these different forms, right? All of these different patterns of ideas, I can hold them all and kind of fluidly cycle through them without overly grabbing on or identifying to one of them. So complexity, the Jains calling it anekantavada, right? Which literally means the doctrine of non-absolutism, and then shunyata or emptiness phenomenologically from the Buddhist sense, right? Kind of in our logo, there's the enso, and then we have this little American flag thing. It's kind of the form of the nation state, kind of the most dense instantiation of form and matter and, you know, power held in this deeper emptiness. So that's kind of like the phenomenological part, right? And then the epistemological part is focusing on ideology. So that's kind of like how I've been putting this all together in the last few days.
Yeah, I mean, that's great. overall, I don't really have disagreements or really a critique of that. It's just, I'm curious what you think of in terms of the, all right, first of all, like the perspective taking and empathy taking that as a practice, what you're talking about, I feel like that's almost like a bare minimum of like, if we're going to claim to be integralists or metamodern thinkers, et cetera, just having that capacity and training that capacity is like learning to walk, or it's like learning how to use our body's nervous system, right? Like figuring out that this leg moves with that leg, or our body can move in a kind of holistic way that creates motion. It's like really trying to flex all the different muscles and areas and corners of our body, right? But it is sort of an intellectual cultural body. Being able to do that fluidly allows us to be able to kind of, yeah, have empathy and have a sense of the whole interrelationship between things without reducing it, right? Or reifying it in any particular way. So I think that's really important to do as a general practice. And that's kind of the implicit, as a sort of an adjacent understanding, that's the implicit understanding that Gebser has with the structures of consciousness, that you really have to be moving back and forth between all of them in order to really kind of get the sense of, McLuhan used that kaleidoscopic description as well to talk about the different communication mediums and sort of like the electronic human being of electronic culture is this dynamic integral being that's fluidly moving between the whole history of electronic or oral or script or the whole history of electronic and communication mediums, right? Like, so how do we do that today, presently? I think that's a good start, right? Just in terms of our own political leanings. But then I think the underlying question that moves back into worldview is I think a lot of these particular, whether they're conservative or whether they are, this is a question, an inquiry into ontology, sort of the deeper rooted ontology. Is there something they all share? And as you're moving back and forth, is there a kind of gestalt? Is there a kind of structure that's almost, again, at that kind of deeper strata that constitutes all of these different political flowerings, right, and niches? Is there a kind of a structure underneath that they all sort of share, right? A civilizational structure or a sort of macro or meta historical structure over the past 500 years that have made this kinds of, I don't know, political complexification even possible to begin with, right? Because then that gets into, for me anyway, like that gets into being able to hold both the differentiation and then also the kind of ontological roots or of worldview, right, of modernity and its trajectory into the postmodern and metamodern. Can we hold all of that together? I mean, that's almost so much that like to exhaustively conceptually do so would maybe be impossible, but is there nevertheless like a structure of feeling, a sense of the whole? Because this is where I think the liminal web folks, metamodern folks, and the integral folks are all talking about accessing, right? They're talking about some game B civilizational leap, and they don't want anything to do with any of the kind of political differentiations of left and right or libertarian, et cetera. They want to move into something different. But obviously I don't agree with that kind of like totalizing bifurcation. And yet, nevertheless, there is a sense, there is like a kind of shared gestalt that all of these political orientations have. And is there a reworking of the whole thing right now? And I guess that's my question. Like, how do we feel into that or sense into that? Because that would be the kind of Gipserian ontological inquiry, I think, for us.
Yeah, fascinating. I'm wondering if you could give another example in terms of finding a deeper underlying structural pattern between ideologies that perhaps at first glance would be diametrically opposed to each other, right? So are you saying like, oh, like, you know, these kind of collectivist, more like socialist left-leaning ideologies might be in direct opposition to more individually focused libertarian free market decentralization, deregulation ideologies, but they're still underpinned by an underlying kind of modernist framework or underpinned by kind of Cartesian, mental rational kind of a world space that gives both, yeah, that gives rise to these more surface competing, yes, factions.
Yes.
Okay.
And maybe in addition to, like, you know, talking to like, just say your chat with Jason Snyder and a doomer optimist orientation is like, Jason seeing these kinds of interesting alignments between the more conservative oriented or libertarian oriented localists and then the more permaculture oriented left-leaning, you know, reclaim the commons localists that they're both kind of moving towards the localization and the ecological and having a different relationship with national identity. I mean, that's transforming. So there's a kind of a reorientation that I think folks like Snyder are pointing to, or folks like Bruno Latour are pointing to, where it is true that we are no longer left or right. We're all, what's he call it? We're all terrestrials, right? We're all kind of reorienting towards the terrestrial. But that doesn't mean we can't be unaware, ignorant of the previous political constellations, right, in the political landscape, because everyone's still in that transition of moving towards, I guess that's my other question, right? Is there an awareness of that underlying redirection or turning towards the local, the terrestrial, or the Gaian realities, et cetera? And can we even understand conservative movements that are sometimes flights from that in sort of the post-truth turn or alternative fact turn as equally reactions against this new reality, right? Fleeing attempts to escape that reality and kind of reify a different sort of postmodern reality where climate change doesn't exist and they can keep on burning fossil fuels. So I guess that's my question. Like, what is the underlying shared common reality that is A, dissolving underneath all the political orientations' feet, and then B, what is it reorienting towards, Right. Because I feel like a meta ideological position would be the most equipped to be able to navigate that, you know, because you're not necessarily locked into left or right, even if you have political leanings on the left. And I agree with you for having those. Right. So I think having that fluidity is sort of a prerequisite to be able to make this turn right into whatever this prefigurative reorientation is. Yeah. So I don't know if that's exactly a question, but. No, that's where I would go with MIP.
Because this gets kind of to why I kind of abandoned the liminal web scene. So I think the biggest thing for me is, and you know, we can have a philosophical debate about this, or this is just my own opinion of where I am in my life professionally and personally, but I don't really vibe with the this is what comes next stuff. The this is what comes next, metamodern Hanzi world where we, you know, developmental theory is brought front and center, and we can have a deliberately developmental civilization that's going to be of this kind of metamodern quality, or this is what next comes next, a kind of, you know, non-rivalrous, anti-rivalrous game B, you know, game theoretic restructuring in which the fundamental interactions in reality are not predicated on rivalrous dynamics, right? Or I feel kind of like I'm kind of like, okay, like I don't get excited. Like the kind of, I think in our, in these liminal web communities, there's so much excitement about like the what comes next as like the new worldview, the new paradigm, the new thing. And this is where I think I'm a hardcore conservative in this regard, is like, I don't really care or even really feel comfortable with that. My kind of underlying ontology, the underground, is civic fragmentation of civil society, breakdown in democracy, and depolarization at that kind of level. As I was joking with Raven, I'm really a normie, like at heart. I'm really kind of I call myself like a meta normie, you know, like in metamodernism, there's an artistic movement called normcore. And I think that's like, yeah, that really kind of sums me up. And so in terms of the kind of big picture, you know, talking about civilization and stuff, I'm like, yeah, okay, that's really interesting. Like I'll engage with that. And, you know, I love Gebser, you know, kind of a big picture integral vision. I love, you know, books like, you know, Robin Wright's Non-Zero, and, you know, not that I agree with everything, but I do get value out of big picture stuff. But as I always say, meta-ideological politics is not a this is what comes next thing. It's just a toolkit to help with depolarization and better political sense-making and dialogue, right? There's no like, and that's what I mean about like kind of negating the ontology, but the underlying ground that I'm trying to revitalize is the shared civic ethos and space together as citizens who have become so polarized ideologically and politically that we can't have any kind of coherent relationship or community, right? So I'm kind of like a hyper local pragmatic, like I'm just trying to help like my community not destroy each other, like in Portland, like literally not kill each other in the streets, right? And so I got into doing extremist de-radicalization work, and I got into doing nonviolence work and working with nonprofits and at a very pragmatic level. And none of these communities or stakeholders or people that I work with really have any interest in big picture liminal web what comes next. They're just like, dude, I don't want my daughter to get shot when she goes out. And that's kind of the level I'm working at. And so because of that, I've really gravitated away from big picture thinking or underlying structural thinking, just to like, how can I help you? How can I help make your, you know, life experience safer and more meaningful and so forth. So that's kind of, I think that's kind of my pivot away from this scene, and why I don't really feel like this is my tribe. I don't have a tribe. I'm just emptiness.
Nice. Yeah. Though I do hear ontology in that. I do hear a desire to go back to the ground and help people in the immediate and the local, right? And your inquiry, yes, into how do we help resolve political fragmentation? Our society is highly, highly fragmentized and atomized. And as you know, there's good analysis at the structural level, whether we're talking about a Marxist analysis of late capitalism being one of these sort of drivers for hyper fragmentation, atomization of society. But what the answer always is, I think, when you take the superstructure, the substructure, is to kind of move. I think the move you're talking about is an embodiment of that ontology. So that's my only pushback, that I think you're already doing, you're already kind of embodying it, in the sense of you're looking for a shared ground, and that's ontology, right? Like that is how folks learn how to be in the world with each other and have a shared sense of world. That might differ conceptually. And I don't think it necessarily even needs like the meta theory or the galaxy brains to kind of hold all of it. I think it's it's being implemented at the level of everyday life, right? If we can't identify ontology at that level, then it's an abstraction from what's actually going on, right? So I find like your move towards the local, towards you know, remediating hyperpolarization and cultural fragmentation, it's all part of a piece in terms of this move towards Gaia or a new shared reality or an attempt to find it, right? A desire for it through various means, both pathological and maybe more constructive and more remedial. But that move, I think that turning is exactly this kind of ontological turning that a lot of the folks are attempting to describe as like, oh, the metamodern age is next. Or, you know, I love the regenerative culture community folks and what they're doing, but you know, ultimately they're talking about that move too, which is like, how do we feed people? How are everyday people in our neighborhood going to be able to eat in the next 30, 40, 50 years as all of this ecological stuff gets worse, right? And supply chains get affected worse. And we need to rethink our economic superstructure and perhaps relocalize it, et cetera. So I see this as a move towards the local, right? As a kind of embodied turn towards the human and relational. And the only way to do that is to actually get back to the local and the relational and learn how to build a civic structure together, wherever that might be. I don't know if it's going to be the same as it was 50, 100 years ago. I don't think it will be. But that turn or reversal to the local, I think is one of the primary reorientations that we're seeing, a move away from the kind of hyper-abstracted and extractive, you know, capitalist economies towards the more localized, less atomized, less fragmented, right? How do we kind of make that turn is a very difficult question that it's hard to abstract too much, right? We kind of have to go into exactly what you're talking about. Like, well, here's what I'm doing in Portland, right? And here's the concerns. It has to be embodied in the explicitly local and contextual, and yet it's transparent to the kind of bigger picture ideas. My problem with a lot of the liminal web in the meta community is that they haven't been able to make that move back and forth between like, oh yeah, totally, what you're doing is exactly what we're talking about, but we're here abstracting it, right? Where we have an abstract map of it, but here's it actually being implemented in culture, right? Here are folks just dealing with it as a lived reality and attempting to work through it. Is there anything we can glean about that, right? I don't see them looking at that as much. They get more excited about their projects, right? Where they're, I don't know, have some new think tank or some kind of research project where they're gonna solve the world or problems. But I think the world is going to be solved just by people living, you know, in their communities, trying to find a way to create a habitable future together, right? I don't know if that exactly makes sense, but I hear an ontological turn in your description for MIP as like, no, I'm just living it. Like my ontology is what I'm embodying. Like, so yeah.
Beautiful, yeah, beautiful, I love it. It's kind of like a critical ontology exercise, right? It's like, you know, what are my latent ontological assumptions that are acting as a bedrock or foundational bedrock for my thinking? I think to me that my highest ideal really is this kind of old, you know, Tocquevillian notion of civil society. You know, I get really excited about things like the Lions Club and the Rotary Club and all these like old white boomer normie organizations that are doing civic revitalization work, and depolarization is obviously a big part of that. But just like, you know, it's funny because I was initially going to call this project the Diaphanous Citizen. It market tested horribly. Everyone's like, don't call it that. What the hell is that? So I said, okay, you know, we'll go with meta ideology, and it has been more. It's still a bit of a niche term, but it's been more effective in kind of getting the word out for what I'm doing, what I'm interested in, right? But yeah, to me, it's like civil society, and you know, thinking about like what it means to be a citizen, you know, in this time that we're living in, what are our responsibilities and duties as a citizen? How do we treat each other, and how do we rebuild, you know, reforge these civic bonds that have been fragmented by the postmodern age of fake news and social media and informational balkanization and so forth, right? And reclaiming that reality, I think that's something that's very, and again, this is why I say like it's more of a conservative impulse and like rebuilding aspects of a system that have been fragmented, maybe in a different way, right? Maybe the regeneration will take a new form that's markedly different in appearance and how they were in the 50s, right? But there is something about this, like, who's like Putnam, who wrote Bowling Alone. Like, I just get so high off of that kind of stuff. Like, I just, that's just who Ryan is, right? So yeah, that's, I would say that's kind of there. I do want to say, I just want to circle back to one thing though about, I also recalled why I wrote this in the Discord group too, right? Why I kind of pivoted away from the big picture framings, like modernism, pre-modernism, post-modernism, or like those kind of, those epistemes or those very general categories. I found there was a kind of ideological bypassing problem where if our categories are too high level and too abstract and too general, we miss out on the nuances and granularities and ideological specificity of certain schools of thought or frameworks that we would kind of brush to the side or even just completely dismiss, right? Either we dismiss them as saying, oh, so Marxism or whatever, anarchism, whatever, it's just a whole bunch of ideologue horseshit. You're not going to get any value out of studying that or engaging with someone of that, of those persuasions, or just subsuming it into the larger category, being like, oh, well, that's just modernism or that's just post. So you slap the general label on, and then you don't get the good insights that you have to do a little more digging into, right? At the more granular level. This is obviously a theme that came up in the debate I hosted between you and Josh Leonard of the Post Progressive Institute, right? And you know, I love Josh. He's a good friend of mine. But like they wrote on the website, I don't know who wrote this, Carter Phipps or Steve McIntosh, they wrote on their website, they're talking about depolarization, they're talking about integrating these epistemes, right? The new kind of post-progressives or integral sphere that takes the best of traditionalism and modernism and progressivism and so forth. And then they wrote, and we are largely against Marxism and critical theory. And they didn't say like, we're against Nazism, we're against libertarianism, we're against fascism or whatever, right? It was like kind of singling out those theories. And I'm like, I don't agree that, I mean, I'm against totalizing overly literalistic, fundamentalistic interpretations and enactments of those ideologies, as I am with any ideology. But I think that if held from a meta-ideological perspective, by dismissing those explicitly or implicitly, you're really missing out on a lot of good stuff. And I'd say that not only, I'm kind of picking on it from a left angle, but I could say that for any angle of anything, right? We're missing out on core insights, and that actually works to our detriment in trying to bridge these divides practically and conversationally, right? So I really wanted to get more granular and specific. And then let's all this conflict about CRT, critical race theory, right? And I'm like, has anyone ever actually read critical race? Like really specifically, like read the scholars, right? Read Mary Matsuda and Richard Delgado and Derek Bell and Kimberly Crenshaw. And like, let's not just dismiss that as, oh, this is just mean green meme, like, or postmodernism. Like let's actually see what's really happening here and come to our own conclusions from reading the source texts, right? And same goes with anything anyone else would dismiss as, oh, this is just, you know, fundamentalist traditionalism, right wing, whatever. I'm like, no, let's read what all the post-liberal Catholic integralists are saying, right? What is Patrick Deneen saying? What is Sohrab Ahmari and Adrian Vermeule and all these guys who have kind of, in my opinion, kind of a theocratic vision of where they want to go, but there are still important themes that they're touching on that need to be integrated, right? I'd even go as far as say, like, we should all be reading Alexander Dugin's Fourth Political Turning, right? Like this kind of postmodern conservatism, like what is there, right? How are they appropriating Nietzsche and Heidegger and Julius Evola and Carl Schmitt and the whole kind of like alt-right canon? Like there's a kind of existential angst and anxiety there and a longing to return to some kind of Dasein. It might be instantiated or framed in different ways, but like there's something there, you know, like we should really try to, and our friend Eric is going to do a podcast series, like really getting into this, which I'm really excited about, but like, yeah, like we're missing out on so many of the nuances, right? We're bypassing so many of the granularities and the specific insights from all these different diverse schools of thought by just going to these very generalized abstractions. So anyway, I just wanted to throw that out there.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I'm in agreement. I mean, that was my point to Josh, that we can't be inflexible about holding those scales. I guess for me, I think holding them lightly in terms of worldviews, it's useful, but we have to see them in that kind of deeper way, like not as a sort of abstract term that's a box that everything fits into, but like, how is this sort of a deep root or deep morphological structure of the whole history of modernity, right? That's helped to shape and afford us all of these new possibilities politically, et cetera. It's a generative thing. It's almost an historically generative thing. That's kind of my take. I don't like the abstract top-down, look at it from a thousand feet and put everything into the box of modern and postmodern and then write it off. It's like, you're part of the process in which that has arisen. And even if that's a useful category to call something descriptively modern, it has the history, it has complexity, right? And it has a sort of generating force that still informs, is made up of down orientation for like any kind of big picture terminology and categories. But then moving into granularity, I think is very important as well. Like sure that the granular has kind of flowered out from, right? But just be able to go back and forth, I think is really important. I think the problem is with a lot of these folks, they stay at the kind of macro historical perspective of these giant categories that fit giant swaths of history and human populations into and say like, okay, everyone who's green, they believe in, I mean, they're almost become caricatures of history rather than obfuscate complexity rather than invite it, right? Like there's a kind of like, okay, I know what that is, that goes in that box, rather than, I don't know, there's a whole interesting weird structure underneath there that like would be a big rabbit hole to go down, like with Dugin we should be a little bit trepidatious about holding the whole picture, because it's A, both dangerous, and then B, it will inform us in how our own thinking has been shaped. So we're dealing with a kind of living history in that sense. And I don't get that sense with a lot of the integral folks that kind of play with this as if these are kind of, I don't know, again, box categories in like a video game, and you can kind of move them around and you're not part of it, but you're manipulating it from above or from afar. So I don't like that. I think that that's a very bad way of dealing with going meta or going macro historical, et cetera. But I do want to hold out for the macro historical and say, like, I think it is important. And often I think it's missing in the granularity of being able to take different perspective taking, right? I think a part of the problem is there's a lot of granularity today and not a lot of connection making, right? And not a lot of pattern recognition. But instead of doing both, which I hear is what you're doing, but instead of doing both, we have this weird bifurcation where we have the kind of like complete entrenchment and hyper fragmented positions and debates and arguments and granularity, right? Where it doesn't get anywhere in a sense. And then on the other hand, we have like the counterculture folks that are just outright rejecting the whole thing without analyzing it, without coming to an awareness of it, a construct awareness of it, and then moving into a new direction to try to bifurcate into some new game B attempt and replicating all of the same problems that are part of their own makeup. They haven't analyzed it. And so they bring it into the new, right? And so we see a lot of like a recapitulation of the same kinds of problems in these communities, like at a kind of micro level. I was just watching or reading and looking at Fred Turner's From Counterculture to Cyberculture by Fred Turner. He did a Jacobin podcast talking about the book. And it's a really interesting kind of repeat of history where essentially the boomers in the 1960s and 70s went off and created all these alternative communities, basically creating game B scenarios where they basically were all saying, we're walking away from the military industrial complex. We're going to go back to nature and live a life of peace. And this is the next stage of human culture or whatever. And they like recapitulated all of the patriarchal, weird, cultish problems that you would imagine would go into creating a commune with, you know, a male leader in the middle of nowhere. A lot of these communities completely imploded and fell apart because none of that was really analyzed. And the ones that actually survived were the longest were the ones that were situated in more urban environments and doing that kind of mediational work between kind of the way things are and the way things were aspiring for them to be in terms of the new counterculture, being able to kind of situate a position of relationality between like experimenting with something new and being in the context of the old and needing to constantly translate that, I think it's a much better position for a lot of these communities. I know I'm kind of going on a sidetrack here, but I'm wary of the bifurcation, I guess, in a lot of the game B liminal spaces. And part of that would be like not being able to have the kind of granularity that you're talking about here. Like by dismissing everything wholesale or not looking at the history of the postmodern or green meme, there's sort of a deliberate walking away from a fluidity and literacy and therefore self-knowledge, right? in terms of what they might be carrying into their social experiments for new ways of living and being. I don't know if that all makes sense, but
yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
I want to say too, also, sorry, my internet got a little slow at one point. So you kind of slowed
it.
But I think we captured most of what you're saying. So I apologize to the audience, but yeah, this is interesting because I also want to say too, kind of just to put a caveat here that, like, you know, you and I both are intellectuals and have a lot of interest and passion in these things. And we have, you know, more or less the time to get into the granularities and explore these things. But for a lot of people, yeah, like they don't have the time or inclination or aptitude or you know, scholarly interest, which is totally fine. Like we're not promoting kind of intellectual elitism here, right? But rather just, I think, the truly penetrative epistemic humility and what I've been calling like Dunning-Kruger self-awareness, like of knowing how much we don't know about something before we label it and dismiss it, right? I think, just to go back to what you were saying earlier, though, and this is, again, why I really centered ideology, and there's a school of thought actually called ideology critique, which is all about, it's very critical theory-ish, it's all about surfacing latent ideological assumptions that have latched on to what appear to be non-ideological ideas or projects, right? So, like, what are the ideological and political ramifications of this that we're not being aware of because we're not ideologically literate and, like, you know, trying to, like, snuff it out, so to speak, right? Bring it into the light. And there's a British systems theorist named Wendy Gregory. She has a great stuff on ideology critique. So it's used alongside like people who are like organizational consultants and community developers, actually. So it is a school of thought. But I think where it's really helpful is that I've worked with a lot of communities, Buddhist communities, religious communities, spiritual communities that are dealing with polarization. And so I've seen a lot of the dynamics in those communities are very similar to the political polarization that seeped into the liminal web. We're valorizing qualities that everyone agrees with at one level. Compassion, perspective taking, open-mindedness, fluidity, right? We can, if we want to frame it developmentally, we could say, you know, the attributes or qualities that are associated with higher developmental stages are being valorized and encouraged, right? This kind of multi-perspectivity, you know, this kind of construct aware fluidity, blah, 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 blah. But our political intelligence is so bad, right? Our political intelligence, our capacity to talk about politics in a nuanced and depolarizing way is so lagging behind everything else, right? We can talk about religion and spirituality and philosophy and all these subjects. It's all rosy and wonderful and we're vibing and synergizing. But as soon as it comes to a political disagreement, especially about charged issues, it's like our level of discourse and the complexity and fluidity just tanks, right? And so those qualities that we're encouraging don't penetrate into the political and ideological realm, right? It's like, I'll talk about these things at a, I don't know, whatever, second tier, integral, whatever level, unless it comes to politics, I'm dropping all the way back down to red or whatever. It's like, oof, right? So emphasizing ideology and a politics explicitly around harnessing ideology consciously as a kind of sense-making tool, an action tool, to kind of develop the complexity of your worldview, right? This is meant to really bring those qualities and just firmly stamp them into politics and be like, okay, it's not going to be like politics is over here, the spiritual nice stuff is over here, and the two will never meet or touch or interpenetrate, right? And so my idea of like my like goofy little checklist of like the five pillars of meta-ideological awareness, right? Like, how do we assess our relationship to an ideology? And so the five I came up with, and the list is not exhaustive or final, it's just kind of provisional checklist, but it's like, there are depth, distance, diversity, discernment, and diaphanity. It's five Ds, right? The alliterative chain there, right? So the depth is thinking about how deeply you understand something, right? How clear, how vivid of a steel man, how nuanced and complex is your understanding of this subject? I.e. Richard Wolff knows a hell of a lot more about Marxist theory than I do, right? His depth of scholarship and understanding of Marxism is way deeper than mine. Second one would be is distance, which is how much kind of detachment or non-attachment do you have to that ideology, right? Have you merged it with your identity or can you kind of hold it at arm's length, or can you kind of like reflect on it and not be entangled with it or get triggered when someone attacks it, right? So there's the distance aspect. The diversity is like internally diversifying your ideological toolkit, right? As I say, from ideological monocropping to ideological polycropping, right? It's like saying, how many other frameworks or perspectives can you hold and cultivate? And internally cultivating that diversity cognitively, that's another thing to consider, right? Or are you just looking at the world through one lens? even if it's very deep and you have some detachment, it's still kind of like one frame, right? So diversifying the frames of reference, but the discernment is knowing at the appropriate time when is like the when is at the right lens of analysis. And again, this kind of gets back to the Jordan Hall thing on the Churchin's elite overproduction. It's so there's a debate about like, okay, like that's probably a useful heuristic, but is it appropriate to use it in this situation? That's the discernment part. And of course, your capacity to discern is based on all of the other factors, right? Like diversity. Like you can't discern well if you don't have options. And the fifth one is diaphanity, which is what I got from you and Gebser, which is this quality, this felt subjective quality of translucency and transparency, seeing through the frame, seeing the construct awareness or construct transparency, right? The form and emptiness, right? You see them as forms, you see them as reifications, as abstractions, but they're not really reality. Reality is deeper and beyond and more complex than that reification. But if we embrace that as a reification, we can play with it, right? We can experiment with crystallizing it more, we can diaphanize it, we can fluidicize it, right? But just knowing that it is a lens and that we're seeing through it ultimately is the goal. So that's kind of how I think about, and the idea is that like, if one were to hold those, anything can work because you have the proper pillars to have a healthy relationship to ideology. And so that takes the scare quotes off of Marxism or anarchism or whatever, CRT, whatever people are scared of or allergic to, think are dangerous, right? It's kind of post-Nietzschean alt-right appropriations. Like you can engage with them in a way that's not scary because you're not afraid that's going to take you over. You're holding it in a healthy, kind of wholesome way, right? Anyway, yes.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. I'm kind of curious though, actually, in terms of, because ideology is such a scary word, right? And this is a great way to kind of unpack that and actually make it not so scary. Especially for the right, right? Especially the right and the IDW and a lot of the counterculture, ideology is again, this very negative thing. So I'm curious about your experience in helping folks kind of go through these principles and explore them and implement them. Has it been effective in reaching folks who find ideology a scary word to begin with? I'm just curious about how it's landing and also how you've seen it become effective in terms of who you've been working with.
That's fantastic. So I would say that it definitely has a left bias in terms of the attractor for all the reasons that you said, right? Like if you read the CRT scholars, a lot of them will say CRT is an ideology. It's one that demands full commitment in its implementation to create a just, racially just society. But it is there is actually nominally a reference to it being an ideological thought structure, right? So several things. One is that like it kind of doesn't matter what people's conception of it is and of what ideology is in terms of high response. Let's say someone says one thing you hear a lot these days, right, is ideology is like a religion, or it's like a perverse, fucked up, pseudo religion that's acting as a kind of false replacement for genuine religion. I think Jordan Peterson holds this view. So my response, if people say that, I say, okay, that's fine. If ideology is a religion, then I'm Joseph Campbell. The second one is ideology is in itself bad because it destroys complexity. Sure, that's why meta-ideological and polycropping consciously is the answer, right? That's my response. Ideology is neutral. Okay, great. So we can work with it, right? We can work with it consciously. We can engage with it consciously. So there's kind of that angle. I think the right angle, the angle that gets people on the right excited about meta-ideology is in that frustration of calling, the kind of woke DEI stuff, like, oh, the left is totally brainwashed, right? They're totally captured by these ideologies, and there is the anti-ideological streak. I'm trying to kind of jujitsu that into the meta ideology, right? Like, yeah, you're right. Ideological fundamentalism is a huge problem. But which way are we going, right? It's kind of like a pre-post thing. So that it's like the meta ideological turn is like, yeah, this is literally, it literally means beyond ideology. And so then people do get excited. Now I say, okay, well, let me unpack what that actually means, right? Like we're never going to be totally beyond it, but we can be beyond its totalizing power to just capture us completely, right? And that actually gets a lot of people excited because they're like, yeah, all these guys are just fundamentalists, they're religious fanatics. So the qualities of meta ideological theory, right? That's what gets people saying, like, yeah, okay, we can get on board with that. So it does have kind of a bipartisan appeal, but overall still, and it could also just be because I'm more left myself. That's why my Nate co-host Nate, he's on the right, he's a Republican. So obviously he's very much on board with everything, but I think if you asked him what meta-ideological politics means to him, he'd actually give a different answer. It'd be more like a conservative answer. And so I think that's why there's the two of us to, you know, it's a Crystal Sagar thing, right, to balance it out.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. That's a good analogy there. Yeah, I mean, all that sounds good. It, you know, honestly, it sounds like Jordan Hall could use a conversation with you. a lot of this community could use a much more helpful jujitsu move, as you're describing, because I like that you're not necessarily trying to get them to like the medicine. You're trying to get the medicine to go down with like, yeah, you're right. It does taste funky. So we're going to add a little bit of like sweetener in here. We're going to add some other flavors. There's like, it goes well with this little cherry flavor. There you go. So you're kind of giving it the medicine, some kind of supplemental or complemental way to kind of like introduce it or inoculate it. And I like that because particularly for the right, the IDW, any right-leaning and countercultural spaces, ideology is this danger word, right? So any kind of techniques that really make it that jujitsu move where it doesn't become as scary anymore and you're agreeing with them, even as you're allowing them to kind of think about it differently, is really helpful and probably needed. Like, I recommend, I don't think you're going anywhere in terms of like moving away from the game B space, because we're kind of enmeshed. And I know what you're saying, like they're not your tribe. They're not mine either necessarily, but they could use that sort of articulation, I feel like, a lot more. And maybe, I don't know, we could do a Stoa session on this or something and process Hall's thinking about post ideology.
That'd be great. That's why I called out Hall on Twitter. I'm like, dude, let's talk about this. And you know, yeah, let's get into it.
Yeah, because, you know, again, it's like this keeps getting brought up again and again and again, this whole like we need to be post-ideological. And it's, as you're saying, it's like an old hat. You're able to rehearse all of the different counter arguments they might have and give them something else. So I just think pivoting from that position and offering something that's far more fluidic and dynamic and diaphanous, as you were describing, is probably the best move for these cultures if they want to be successful, right? I think part of their problem is the delicate, the emperor has no clothes move, that the emperor has an ideology, but he thinks he doesn't, you know, in terms of a lot of these communities where they feel like they're so beyond it. And you kind of have to pat them on the back and say, you're totally right. You're totally beyond it. And here's why, and here's a useful tool for you, you know? So there's some massaging that I think has to happen in order to do that. But it would be tremendously helpful for them to have a better framework. Although I know that's not your emphasis. You're working again in the much more local and in the immediate context of where you're situated. So, they could use that too. I think a lot of these communities tend to be very uprooted and abstract and not really localized in any kind of context. And to the degree that they are localizing, they want to start their own little micro future community, you know, where they're not really in relationship necessarily with the place that they're situating it in. So at any rate, the venting may continue, but I liked your point about the right context. And it's almost like right action, you know, because with Jordan Hall's comment on bringing up the Turchin thing, there was a general analysis when you mentioned that. This was part of what got us on Twitter talking about this. Hall had mentioned the kind of MAGA-like Canadian truckers, right, and what's going on presently, and he was sort of comparing them to, say, the Starbucks union organizers and kind of questioning why we're rejecting one and embracing the other. There's a lot of good reasons why. There's some cautionary praise from the left, like Richard Wolff said he supports the truckers and what they're doing, but he thinks, you know, if you don't want to get your hands dirty and get involved, then of course there's going to be like a conservative takeover of the leadership, right? Like they're going to get in there. You have to get in there with them. You have to get your hands dirty ideologically. You have to be able to have that fluidity that you're talking about. So that's why, let's say, somebody like Richard Wolff would support them. But Hall was more of commenting on why do we reject the truckers and embrace the union baristas, right? And he was basically redirecting the conversation to bringing up Turchin and the overproduction of the elite, right? The elite overproduction, basically saying there's too many. I mean, what's the implication in the context, right? By using that analysis, the overproduction of the elite is certainly like an interesting analysis in certain contexts, right? Like it, we're looking at, yeah, okay, there's a lot of money to be made in the overproduction of elite certifications and higher and degree of inflation. There's certain market forces that are driving that, obviously. So that's one thing, but when he's using it to compare the two, he's almost kind of saying, well, we have too many, the implication is that, the union organizers are superfluous in the barista context, right? Like, well, there's too many of them and they're thinking too much in that context and they're making unions and the problem might be just like, we don't need them, you know? So I don't know where he was going with that, but that ambiguity he left there was again, because I think your point about, you know, right application and right context, and then B, by believing that he was post-ideological, he was sort of reifying a very centrist ideology. You know, it's basically Biden's argument that, like, I have no sympathy for the elite overproduced millennial generation, right? So where do we go with that? I think not having a literacy about these things is really the kind of problem, because the literacy means free, what I'm understanding with MIP is literacy means context, right? It means knowing the contextual relationship between these different ideological, political, and economic positions, and being able to move back and forth means like you kind of understand the landscape as it is alive in context, in community, and why people are generating a particular worldview, or being able to take that empathy position requires the development of context and relationship with those positions and those people, right? And if you don't, if you're just seeing it from afar, you're going to have very weird analysis, you know? And I think that's kind of the problem I've continued to have with a lot of Hall's thinking. It's this very kind of removed, weird analysis of things that seems to be out of context from what's going on. I don't know if that rant exactly made sense, but...
Oh, yeah, it's great. There's lots to unpack there. I mean, I think when it comes to having conversations, right, promoting more critical ideological awareness and so forth, right? Like, I think what Hall is a good example of, Turchin doesn't fit into the ideological, you know, well, how we would usually categorize a thinker as being ideological, right? Turchin's not like a Marxist or a libertarian or whatever. But that kind of statement, which appears to be ideologically and politically neutral or outside of the polarized game, still has a lot of ideological ramifications or pretexts that or at least lean in that direction, right? So it's like, oh yeah, like there is an ideological kind of there's always a political dimension to it, right? And to properly contextualize that does take a certain amount of like literacy and kind of critical examination, I think. And again, I think the pragmatic part of it is it helps with depolarization communication, right? Because you can just say that, like, oh, this could be the implications, or, you know, this is the lens that I'm using and it could be seen this way, or yeah, maybe these are, you know, different ideologies I genuinely agree with or find value in. Something I find interesting, couple points, right? One is that you'd mentioned like the IDW types weaponizing the label of ideology against the left. A lot of them though are very honest about their ideological leanings, right? Like James Lindsay, right? Kind of like the anti-woke guy, like, he says explicitly, like, he's for reviving classical liberalism, right? That's what Dave Rubin also says. Jordan Peterson just went on, was it Dr. Oz? And he was like, I'm a traditionalist, or I'm a classical British liberal. Like, those are all ideologies, right? So if you want to say, this is why I think this ideology is better, then yeah, I'm willing to have that conversation. At least that we can start having a conversation instead of just saying, I don't have an ideology, right? And then everything you say is hella ideological. Second problem I've noticed is, and maybe this does actually, to tie it full circle, connect back to the ontology question, there's a deeper problem too with disciplinary polarization, where someone associates a specific political school of thought or ideology with an underlying like field of thought, and then throws the baby out with the bathwater of the field. Common example would be like someone who talks about sociology, and people think that that language is too close to social justice or wokeism. So they're like, oh no, this is just more like social justice. Get this SJW shit out of here. But you really just discarded a whole bunch of sociological concepts. Like you're dismissing sociological reality or as a field of study. Same thing happens like when Jordan Peterson criticizes some like woke developments too. It's very obvious he's coming from a psychological perspective, right? So he was like, oh. So his critiques are, it's really like psychology's battling sociology. It's a deeper thing than just like the ideological political positions clashing at the top, right? There are developments that I think are problematic on the left in certain like woke contexts where there's too much emphasis on sociology and sociological power relations, right? In a very kind of postmodern way. And they kind of throw out psychology, and spirituality, right, or consciousness, or they throw out even economic theories, right, like the whole race reductionism versus class reductionism. I was talking to Brent Cooper about, you know, intra-group polarization on the left, and even CRT scholars explicitly say one of the weaknesses of CRT is that there's no coherent class or economic theory to accompany it. So that needs to be developed, or else you're going to be reductionistic and partial, and you're going to miss out on a whole bunch of stuff and polarize a lot of people, right? So there needs to be a kind of a disciplinary consilience that goes along with all this too. I see what guys like Jim Rudd and Jordan Hall and a lot of these sense maker types, right? Especially like Santa Fe guys. Santa Fe's school of complexity theory, as I understand it, is very scientifically based. They get physicists together, they get biologists together, right? And they get all these different, these diverse science schools and experts together to come up with a kind of a new complexity paradigm that integrates all of these different disciplines. From a scientific lens, if you're not coming from a political science lens, which is kind of what I'm coming from with ideology studies and ideology theory, ideologies is a bad thing from a scientific perspective. Like you don't really want to be ideal. Like it's like the kind of pejorative definition of ideology is a framework of, you know, political thinking and action that's immune to epistemic revision. It's immune to empirical revision. And given that science is all about empirical revision, yeah, I could see how ideology is diametrically opposed to science. So from a scientific lens, yeah, ideology is not good. But from a political science lens, it really just is a neutral term to describe people's political worldview and partisan affiliation. So I think there needs to also be a kind of an interdisciplinary consilience too, and really tease out like, what are all these dimensions that are battling each other, right? What are all these dimensions that are... you know, this is even where like Wilbur's quadrants, going back to something so simple, could be useful, because it's just like, let's not conflate political activism and ideology with the underlying, the discipline that underpins it, right? And let's make sure not to throw the baby out with the bathwater and understand these things from, you know, on its own terms, so to speak. So that's just something I've noticed. That's another element of polarization I don't see a lot of conversation about, but it's very salient to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's speaking to, again, the ontological questions of what is reality? What is the underlying reality that we can know, right? Does it need to be hyper-fragmented and specialized, right? And we produce specialized knowledge. I mean, this is part of the ways in which the sort of the macro historical structures of consciousness orientation can be helpful is understanding that the production of knowledge in the West and in modernity tends towards hair splitting, specialization, fragmentation, smaller and smaller and smaller fields that become much, much more complex. And so being able to talk between the fields becomes increasingly harder. And we've seen this kind of branch out over time. So the sort of intra-polarization that's happening within like the left, you're saying like CRT has a really good analysis, but it's extremely partial, but really important. And it could be in better relationship with fields adjacent to it, right? That would kind of complement what it's looking at. But we don't really have that sort of consilience or sort of intra transdisciplinarity that kind of, again, the ontology here of what's between these fields, what we know, right? We don't have that kind of shared ground to be able to kind of go, oh yeah, there's kind of a commons or a kind of a shared reality of knowledge making, and we need to be able to do better at like leaping across disciplines and weaving disciplines together. That's an example, like if you're working at this at the political civic level, like that's the example of fragmentation manifesting, you know, in the academic epistemic level of terms of, you know, how we produce knowledge in our society tends to be very fragmented. So that becomes a problem, right? And then we see this on the left, just generally culturally, we have these different competing fields that are always at war with one another. CRT is always attacking, I don't know, I think the CRT folks don't like Bruno Latour. So I always see like them throwing flack at Bruno Latour's work. But then, you know, a lot of folks dismiss CRT on the left, actually, especially a lot of Marxists, they kind of look at it incredulously. So there's a lot of intra-fighting and intra-fragmentation, which is profoundly frustrating, even on the left. What was the other point? But yeah, the ontological underlying question there, like, is there a shared reality? Is, if it is ontologically complex, as you're talking about, if the underlying reality is sort of a complex hyper-object, then, and if we can agree to that across different disciplines, then we might be able to get to begin to build that consilience project or develop more relationality. I mean, it's the same kind of problem, again, is that you're dealing with, and the civic social level is exactly the way we're, what we're dealing with in terms of how we build knowledge in the academy and what the structure of the academy looks like. So it's almost like a kind of a fractal phenomena that is manifesting across culture, right? A cultural phenomenology problem. So again, I think there's almost like a Mobius strip, and I've referred to this in my own writing about this, like in terms of the kind of granular specificities that we need to focus on, depending on our discipline and our knowledge base. And then the kinds of fractality, right, that manifests across culture, right, across perhaps a civilizational superstructure or the global system level, that have been replicated across the planet and replicated across how we just make knowledge today, that really need to be addressed. And how do we identify what those shared problems are, right? I think we have to move into ontology in order to do that. And then develop different ways of, like, okay, do we do Nicolescu's transdisciplinarity, Morton's hyper-objects? Like, how do we make that ontological move is another question. But identifying fragmentation wherever it's showing up, it like gets us at least a kind of a foothold into, okay, there's a shared ground here, even if it's breaking apart, there's a kind of a shared symptom that we're all dealing with that we need to look at here, right? What's producing that shared symptom? But then that's the Mobius strip, because then you go back into, well, studying the granularity and the specific epistemes and the specific political historical context, right? And specific political knowledge bases, right? We have to kind of go into that as well, but always be kind of doing that diaphanous move of that Mobius strip where you go back into worldview orientation, et cetera, but then back into the granularity, right? Holding the kind of cosmo-local position, right? Very specific in relationship to the whole, and how other aspects of other specificities are dealing with a kind of fractal problem, right? So I don't know. I just feel frustrated because the communities that we both kind of started out in terms of the liminal web, that's what they're calling themselves now. They didn't always, obviously, but they really should be doing that move back and forth. Like, I think that's actually what it means to be liminal, right? It's like not just to be advocating a different kind of society and not studying everything about our society, but being able to move back and forth. That's its own fluidity. Like, if we can't go into game A and game B fluidly, I don't really use this language, but just their terminology, right? If we can't go into game A, understand the political landscape as like, this is just the immediate living historical reality people are in, you know, if we can't do those jujitsu moves into game B, quote unquote, then we don't really have a game B. There is no game B. It's non-existent. We're just creating our own little, postmodern conservative move into our own little countercultural niche and creating our own reality in that niche. So yeah, I think those are kind of the problems of the liminal web. Is like, they're not actually liminal.
Beautiful. So. Yeah. And, you know, I wonder though, Jeremy, like everything that you've been encouraging, right? Everything that you've been piping up about in terms of really gaining literacy, historical literacy, right? Understanding the material context and current economic world situation that we're in, and how these dynamics really inform a lot of what's happening and obviously are very relevant to something like a civilizational transformation towards a more game B world. But like, how much of the illiteracy is the deeming some of these insights as being ideological. Do you know what I mean? Like how much of it is like, well, the Jeremy Johnson lens on understanding these things is, you know, Jeremy Johnson obviously is a depraved Marxist leftist. So we're not going to embrace these insights because we've dismissed those, the schools that generate those insights as being ideologies.
Yeah. Like, do you think that's a huge part of it. I mean, like there's an immune response to touching anything and that's perceived as game A, like,
right.
Although there isn't exactly because, as you're saying, a lot of the folks in IDW will go ahead and proclaim that they're for a particular, I don't know, classical liberalism or something along those lines. So there is, but it's not self-reflected, right? It's like, well, that's good. That's not ideology. That's just classical liberalism. The left is all ideology, right? They have the ideology, we don't. And that's that kind of disowning that I think is going on. So yeah, I mean, if they see someone like me kind of hang out with leftists, then they write off anything else that I'm doing as just on the left, which is part of the kind of bypassing problem that continues to occur, right? Like, I was just looking at James Muldoon's book, Platform Socialism, and what the blockchain socialist was talking about in context about that in conversation with James was, you know, a lot of what he's saying about the history of socialism, right, is essentially being reinvented by the tech world without looking at the history of socialism in the 20th and 19th centuries, right? They're coming to some of the same principles and looking at technology for some of the same emancipatory possibilities, but not being informed by the past two centuries of social experimentation on the left that probably would give them quite a lot of insight for like what's effective and what's not. But because it's considered socialist or because it's a leftist movement, they don't want to study the history and they don't want to read the books, right? They don't want to actually look at anybody on the left and any more perhaps than what we see on the left, folks not wanting to read Dugin, right? Being totally wanting to write that off and not study it to understand it. So yeah, I would say there's almost like that immune response because of that, that kind of rejection of anything associated with game B, intra-political fighting left and right. They want to throw all that out. But again, I think they're full of contradictions because they don't throw it all out and they embrace more of the right-leaning ideological positions very explicitly, as you're saying. So yeah, a lot more, self-reflection I think needs to take place in these kinds of spaces.
And again,
it's not scary. Like you're saying, it's not scary. Yeah. Like, go ahead, read. It's all right. You can read Marx. You won't turn into some radical Marxist. Like, it's Marx has good insights about our society.
Famous last words.
Yeah.
And I think that's what I'm really trying to do is like this principle of ideological non-exclusivism, right? Which is to me a core aspect of meta-ideological politics. And I'll just share a personal story that I want to touch on one more thing before we wrap up, but I actually led a DEI workshop, which is something I do, my kind of like complexity informed integrative meta ideological DEI, to a very conservative city in Oregon, and to their city staff. And a lot of these people, I know that they were like Trump supporters because they were talking about it during the workshop and it was mandatory. So these guys walked in, they're like, oh shit, like I gotta do this freaking mandatory DEI training, you know, shoot me. And what I found time and time again to be so effective in opening people's perspective, right, opening to novel perspectives that would normally trigger that immune response, is simply to say, look, I don't want to supplant any of your core values. I'm not trying to supersede your personal identity or worldview with my ideology or my ideas, right? You get to keep everything that you believe in. I'm just trying to help you to expand the lens. I'm just trying to help you to add on. And something that comes up a lot is, you know, especially when we talk about race and identity issues, I totally understand this critique, but it's like, these are all just labels, right? All of these are just labels. Why do we have more labels, right? I just see people as people, or I just see reality. I just see systems as it is, or I just follow the evidence. I don't need ideology. I don't need a frame. And what I always say is like, yeah, like you're totally right in the danger of reducing these complex things to a label. But in what ways can the label act as an initial opening to a greater level of complexity, right? So my kind of litmus test or criteria with labels or categories or abstractions is, you know, can they help to enrich the complexity, the real living complexity of the system? Or do they occlude and are using it in a way that kind of occludes and oversimplifies that? So emphasizing enriching complexity in a non-exclusive, non-ideologically totalizing, and both and, you know, inclusive way with whatever you already believe. People are like, oh, one guy actually said, like, I can't believe it. I don't have to give up what I believe in order to, like, take that perspective or metabolize these insights. Holy crap. Like that, he's like, I feel so free, because every other workshop or trainer basically presume that I have to give up everything I believe in, give up who I am, but I don't. I can embrace it in the both and. So that's what I'm hoping with meta ideological politics is we can embrace everything, you know, this, and that overcoming the fear, right? And kind of like, it allows you to start to become more expansive, and you can read things without the fear that it has to be one way or the other, right? You can say, all right, I'm looking for insights to enrich my understanding, to add the complexity. And ironically, this is what Derrida talked about in the lecture when he talked about deconstruction, right? He was saying that deconstruction and looking at the historical genealogy or in Foucault's term, like the historical archaeology and kind of unearthing these latent epistemic framings of certain you know, notions of groups of people or discourse dynamics or whatever. It's all to enrich the complexity of something. It's not just like a nihilistic deconstruction to nothing, but expanding the context actually enriches the complexity of something, right? And I really try to take that to heart with what I'm doing, and framing it that way, I think can get people to make that initial move of open-mindedness that they wouldn't have otherwise made.
Yeah. I'm thinking of a Jeff Salzman line, like, you know how he's like, God bless you. I feel like that's all we could really say at this point, is that, like, yeah, I think doing that in this context, in our society, in the conditions we're dealing with hyperpolarization, to simply be accepted with wherever you are and whoever you happen to be as a starting place of, like, acceptance and going, like, yeah, okay, it's cool to have a position. We're not making that a problem. Just as a different starting place of, like, empathy taking, right? Like, that is a radical act in this society where, like, we're always jumping to everything in our from the markets to social media to, you know, this is like the whole, like, Tristan Harris social dilemma thing where he's kind of focusing on the social media markets, right? The logic of the markets, everything in our society is aimed towards hyper polarization and atomization at this point, because it's extractive, it makes money. And in some ways I find, like, Bifo Berardi's framing he talks about how post-World War II, the colonization of space moved into the colonization of time, and essentially the atomization of the psyche and the individual through digital networks and algorithms. And to be counter to that, right? To make this, again, it's that ontological move to, like, say, hey, you're a human being full of complexity. We're in relationship with each other. What's your context? Just having the spaciousness for that is a very radical post-capitalist move, might I say. Maybe they'll have a different framing, ideological framing for that if they're coming from the right. But for me, like, relationship, human complexity, and the spaciousness to be able to do that and hold that, that's already kind of enacting in the kind of micro, a post-capitalist future. So we need more of that. That's my endorsement of MIP.
Thank you. You hear that, ladies and gentlemen? Yeah. I got Jeremy's endorsement. You have time for, like, one more thing? I just want to
Sure. Yeah. Definitely.
Around. So, okay, here's another frustration. This is very reminiscent of growing down. There's a lot of talk about this, like, meaning crisis. And I just personally do not see how we can talk about a meaning crisis without doing class analysis, like, without nesting that in an economic structural context, right? I go to the gym all the time, and, you know, I live in East Gresham, Oregon, so it's very conservative. I pull into the gym parking lot. I see these big trucks with NRA, Confederate flag, Let's Go Brandon stuff. I talked to a lot of these guys in the sauna. The sauna is kind of like my like, you know, socializing time with a bunch of these guys, you know, mostly working class, very racially and ethnically diverse. Actually, we have a big Russian community. We have a big Hispanic community. We have a Somali community. And these guys tend to be right wing on cultural issues and left wing on economic issues. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a rising trend that, you know, groups like, you know, like Jacobin have been doing a lot of analysis of this. And, you know, these guys complain all day long about how much they hate their job and their life because they're making minimum wage working in an Amazon warehouse, and they feel like they have no future. There's no future. There's no road ahead. They're like, yeah, it's just like a, you know, like a monkey kind of level job. Like, there's no thinking there's no meaning, there's no development of myself. I'm surviving paycheck to paycheck, making just above minimum wage, where my rent that's exorbitantly expensive due to housing inflation and real estate inflation is eating up like upwards of 50, 60% of my income. And it's just the despondency and despair from just feeling like the economic boot of capitalism is on your throat. And like, these are the conversations I'm in all the time. When every day I go to the gym, this is the conversation that happens, right? Mm-hmm. And everything else kind of springs from that, because they're working 40 hours a week. So this is takes up the majority of their time as like a waking sentient being, right? And all of the social pathologies, drug use, addiction, domestic violence, et cetera, that polarization, right, that spring from that economically rooted despair, I don't see hardly anyone talking about this, right? And the path forward, right, whether it's at a baseline, some mechanism to increase wages, if it's economic workplace democratization, stronger unions, allowing people to work part-time with like a UBI or something, even like, you know, personal classes on, you know, the more personal, the conservative side, right? Things like personal finance, learning how to do like entrepreneurial projects and entrepreneurial coaching programs, just some way to just give people a way out, right? What is the way out from just class oppression, just feeling like you have no future, right? This job is not going to lead to anything more. I'm just surviving. I'm just getting by. It's really depressing. And I don't see anyone talking about this in our communities.
The real meaning crisis. I think, and this is where, you know, at least I think we both share this position, but the way I understand it is, even if we're not necessarily going to take a left-leaning ideological framework as our sort of orientation, I think the left-leaning ideological frameworks and analysis like Marxism, et cetera, and Marxist thinkers have the best analysis for the meaning crisis. And that's not where folks want to look, right? They don't want to look at, okay, the exact kind of material conditions that a worker, an Amazon worker, is undergoing, and the kind of bifurcation of class and identity politics, which has tended to happen over the past 40 years, where there's been a lot of social gains, right? A lot of social signaling for inclusion and diversity, et cetera, which are important. Racial, social, this is profoundly important, obviously. But because it has been disconnected from class dimensions, it's lost its teeth in the sense that it's become a way in which power and economic class can continue to consolidate at the top, so that banks can take a knee during, you know, the economic and pandemic crisis, but not actually do any kind of redistribution of wealth or actually kind of not play into gentrification, et cetera, in local cities. Like there's no actual structural transformation that's available. And the left has lost power, even as it's gained kind of a cultural clout, right, in terms of its representation in Hollywood. And so I understand that bifurcation process has an historical trajectory that's been going on for 30 or 40 years. And I think Marxists and leftist thinkers probably have the best analysis about that bifurcation and why that's happening. And also the biggest opportunity for empathy taking that you're describing is like kind of understanding what the material conditions in day-to-day life is for somebody who's an Amazon worker, right? Whose life is devoid of meaning because of their material conditions. So unless the left, and that's the Wolf's critique of rejecting the MAGA truckers in Canada, if the left doesn't get in there and talk with folks who are more on the conservative side and do that kind of mediation, then we're going to give over any kind of these other working class conditions, meaning crisis questions to the right. And that was also Michael Brooks' point, right? About we should listen to what Jordan Peterson's talking to. Why is he so appealing? You know, why are folks so alienated from the sense of a meaningful life? Et cetera, et cetera. What are the conditions of our society that are creating that, right? Because Peterson's not answering those conditions. He's addressing that missing dimension in our lives. But because of his own political leanings, there's this kind of capture of the right with meaning, right? The right has captured meaning. The right has captured the kind of religious and theological and spiritual questions of living in a society that's deeply atomized and extractive. In a very material day-to-day sense, where like you're saying, you could talk to any worker, you know, anybody who's in the working class, and probably get a sense of the meaning crisis from them. the meaning crisis is, I want to give the benefit of the doubt on in the intellectual dark web and the I don't know, the Verveke types, et cetera. Like, the folks who tend to talk about the meaning crisis are like, what, white in the tech world, right? They're kind of secular oriented. And but to give them a fair class analysis shake, I mean, they're not really living a necessarily fulfilling and meaningful life, even if they're just materially more more affluent, if they're more middle class. The tech sector is a horrible place to work. It drives people into the ground, overworking, et cetera, the hustle culture. So they're dealing with it too, maybe not in the kind of inflated sense of self-importance. You know, I think they kind of have a myopic take on what the meaning crisis actually is, which is living under the conditions of totalizing late capitalism, right? Digital capitalism. So again, I don't know what my point is with this other than to say that, yes, we should be looking at Marxism and leftist analysis to diagnose the meaning crisis and the conditions that have brought it forward, and extend the meaning crisis to be not just about the white male crisis, right? The white male life crisis, which it tends to myopically become, because again, there's a bypassing of Marxist analysis and leftist politics because it's too ideological, right? It's not. I mean, in the sense that not always, but at its best, the left has attempted to do that mediational work of worldview and perspective taking, particularly when it comes to labor organizing, where you are working with different perspectives and different cultures and different concert political leanings, and still coming together with a consensus to say, like, hey, we're going to organize, you know. I know you're a MAGA person and I know you are a leftist, but you're both working for this company and you both need your rights. And so that tends to become that sort of, at least when I glean from folks I've talked with and folks like Jane McAlevey, like, there tends to be a mimetic, quote unquote, transformation that takes place there, where racial issues and gender issues might be worked out better when you start with the material conditions of the meaning crisis, which may have to do with better pay and better labor, et cetera. But it needs the left to get in there, right? Anyway, that's my take. There is a meaning crisis, but we're not looking at we're looking at the symptoms, not the cause, right? We're looking at the effluvium of hyperpolarization and not, it's like, what are the underlying conditions of that polarization, which I think a Marxist analysis can actually kind of bring to the table a bit. Or at least a core argument or a core theory to put into our array of different theory making.
Yeah, that's so great, because I think that there needs to be a more diverse conception of the meaning crisis. And again, this gets into the specificity and granularity thing, right? For example, Cornel West, in his book Race Matters, he talked about the Black meaning crisis, basically. And I think he even said explicitly in that chapter that, like, the left does not really understand the kind of internal existential angst and despair of the Black community, right? Obviously nested in the kind of historical, cultural context and you know, looking at kind of just what the Black community has endured historically and how that informs the meaning, right? So it's like, there's no like one size fits all meaning crisis, right? So like, that would be in contrast to some of these guys I talked to at the gym who would be, you know, like white, rural, male, you know, in their 20s or 30s, that's its own form of a meaning crisis. And then there are different reasons why that is, right? And then different ways that people try to address it in themselves, right? Whether it's traditional religion, whether it's grafting onto a toxic ideology that espouses some kind of supremacy or jingoism or something, whether it's finding it in Trump, right, as your kind of a spokesperson representative of your unacknowledged needs. And, you know, not to mention, again, right, like just in the industrial Midwest, right, all this skyrocketing opioid use and this drug epidemic, and, you know, how much of that has to do with outsourcing and automation. You know, there's a town in Washington called Aberdeen that used to be a thriving lumber town. There are actually a lot of towns. And I was looking at the history of this town my wife and I were going to move to, called Longview. And again, it was a lumber town, heavily Democratic, very strong unions, flipped red in 2016 for Trump and never looked back. And that's a theme you'll see all across the United States. So how much of that is job loss, right? And especially for men, right? Men, like, our identities are a little bit more rigid than women. Like, if we lose our job, it's like a huge blow to our everything, right? Our source of income, how we gain standing and prestige and recognition in society. A lot of it is tied to economics and job and, you know, kind of status signaling. So if that's gone, it's a gut punch to who you are and all your pride. And really bad things happen from that. But the causes are economic trends and globalization and neoliberalism and technological developments and automation. And we need to address these issues at that level, right? Whether it's reworking trade policy, whether it's galvanizing unions and union support, whether it's universal basic income, right? Whether it's a public works program, expansion of jobs that can create meaningful jobs for people that create value in the community simultaneously, right? Whatever it is, right? We need to look at structural solutions and systemic transformations. And that's what we're trying to emphasize in the podcast. And so to militate against this slide into solipsism and idealism, right? And only thinking about subjectivity in a vacuum, in an asystemic, acontextual vacuum, which is absolutely not the case.
Yeah, and that happens all the time in these countercultural spaces, right? Like there's always this tendency towards the solution, and the right does this as well, which is how it kind of reifies. I'm just talking about Peterson, for example, right? It's not really about the systemic and structural problems, unless they're the left attempting to create a new systemic structure, right? A new law or something along those lines. But it's about personal salvation, right? It's about our personal relationship with the world. It psychologizes in that style the solution, right? It doesn't really solve the problem of atomization. It just allows atomization to be more dignified, you know, as we kind of march along this sort of larger structural problem that continues to exacerbate. And I think, you know, to some degree, folks have recognized that about Peterson specifically, that he wasn't necessarily really imagining a better society, but a kind of romanticized 1950s classical liberalism, the kind of let's just dial back things a bit. And it's the same kind of, ironically, again, it's the same kind of ideological, whether or not it was intentional on Jordan Hall's part, it was the same kind of ideological move where it's let's blame any kind of social chaos on any kind of left-leaning approaches, right? Social chaos is because of the barista union worker organizing, right? It's the source of the chaos rather than the structural market problems that need to be addressed at the local level, at the organizing level. It's actually that kind of ideological leanings that are destabilizing society, right? Now, I'm sure back, you know, in the 1930s and 20s, when unions were much bigger and efficacious, that a lot of the conservative leanings were saying the same thing about unions, right? But then we have to think about, like, you know, this is something Michael Brooks brought up in his podcast, like, you like the weekend, thank unions for giving you the weekend. So there's some ways we kind of forget and revise our own history about what the gains are for organizing on the left, organizing on around labor for social cohesion, social order, social structure, right? Like union organizing, civic participation are all ways, as you're talking about, to increase social order, right? To increase social cohesion and bonding across different perspectives and decrease fragmentation. The fact that we've eroded or have been eroded, right, in terms of our tendency or capacity to do that is kind of the problem, right? It's in the absence of social clubs and not just unions, right, but different societies that used to have different forms of civic participation. We don't have that sensibility anymore because it's gradually been eroded by the direction of these markets, right, towards more atomization, more individualism, the kind of neoliberal capitalist ideology that's really hijacked the market since the 1970s, really, after the devastating losses that the unionizations faced. So there's like a history there that we just should be aware of. And there's nothing scary about acknowledging that as the history. It's not going to turn you, famous last words, but I don't think it'll turn you into like a Trotskyist or something along those lines, or a Twitter tanky. You're not going to find yourself in that position suddenly. But I do think having that analysis is what's often missing from any of the kind of liminal web discourse about why are we here the way we are? What is the source of the meaning crisis? What is the source of runaway technology? How do we stop social media companies from going in the directions that they are and incentivizing violence and hyperpolarization? It's like we're not tracing it to those kinds of underlying historical structures, A, and then B, then we're not making the necessary move towards organizing and building community again, right? And critique all the left all you want, at least they're going out there, like the DSA is going out there and trying to make these small games in the absence of institutional support from Democrats. Like they don't want anything to do with the DSA either, right? So we're in extremely exacerbated conditions, materially speaking, where the institutions on the left and the right have no interest in actually supporting social cohesion or resolving the meaning crisis in any kind of substantive way. And it's not really about left or right in that sense then, right? It's like, hey, they're taking your jobs away. They're extracting the economies. They're outsourcing labor. What can we do to resolve that is coming together and creating new forms of social cohesion to address that. Because how else do you combat these forces, right? Which are at this point, you know, planetary in scope and scale. I mean, that's the kind of problem. Like I know a lot of leftists and Marxists kind of despair at the material conditions of globalization and the ecological crisis. But I think even then, the answer is that doomer optimist turn towards the local, right? Okay, well, I don't know what we can do to solve everything, but we can at least address these problems in our own immediate communities, for the futures of our own families, right? Where we were hoping to kind of see us go living on in the long term, across generations. What can we do here? So, and that's, again, why, like, interestingly, the regenerative communities and then kind of the civic participation, civic healing practices that you're going into seem to be along the same track, right? Towards localization, towards repairing or reinventing, in some sense, the commons and a shared social ground, I think is tremendously important. I know I'm kind of meandering now, but that's all kind of a piece usually when we end up talking about that.
Yeah, totally. I was talking to Jared Janes about my another kind of difference I have with the kind of liminal web motif of, it feels kind of like, like in Buddhism, there's a bodhisattva and the arhat, right? So the arhat, I think it's more of a Theravadan thing of like, you become enlightened and then you don't reincarnate, right? You're out of the wheel of samsara. Congratulations, you jumped out of the game and you're liberated. I feel a little bit of that, right, from some of these communities or cultures of like, we need to build a new system that's orthogonal and a kind of a paradigm shift, a quantum leap to a new state of affairs, to a new attractor basin. And I feel like it, my bodhisattvic impulses are kind of triggered a little bit, right? Because I want to go into the chaos, into the polarization, into the suffering now in the system, in my local community in Gresham, Oregon, right? Or soon to be in Toledo, Washington, and to really do on the ground work and repair to the best of my ability what's happening currently. Obviously concurrently energizing the attractor towards a new state of affairs and, participating in more revolutionary transformations, but also not leaving behind my community or leaving behind or dissociating from this actual physical ground communal context that I'm situated in, right? And so that's kind of like, I think at the end of the day, like that's kind of where I'm coming from, right? Is, the desire to run for office formally or to really get involved with the current system comes from the kind of more of a bodhisattvic instinct, I think. And, a good amount of personal ego and ambition is there. But I think the bodhisattvic impulse is strong. And so I feel a bit of a distance to that. Like, let's completely build something new, that's out of the historical trajectories and contingencies of the past and our current institutional arrangements. And let's just jump out. And I'm just like, no, I want to go into it.
I agree with you, Ryan. There's one of my favorite essays by Ursula K. Le Guin is California as a very cold place to be. And it's essentially a kind of take on yin and yang and utopianism. And she quotes William Blake, saying he casts off futurity and turns towards the present. For lo, futurity is in the present moment, along those lines, paraphrasing Blake, but it's the idea, Le Guin also says there and elsewhere, that like utopia is either present or it isn't at all, right? Like it's not something we can say it's ahead, right? Let's go there to some new future and cast off where we are presently, you know, because then we have no habitable present. And if we don't have a habitable present, even in that sort of diaphanous Gipserian sense, then we have no past or future. So we have to begin in that kind of bodhisattvic turn towards where we presently are. Like that is what it means to be. Like, again, I just posted a little podcast about this. I know we got to wrap it up soon. But I kind of propose a kind of threefold way of understanding liminality if we are going to actually embrace that term. And it was propositional in the sense that I don't necessarily want to use liminal web or liminality, but I'm just getting sucked into this. It's that meme, like they pulled me back in, right? So threefold understanding of it, like a threshold, right? Okay, that's what we're talking about, being on a threshold. Like you're talking about, okay, there's a civilizational change that is definitely occurring, but how do we actually deal with being on a threshold? Well, I think A, we need, or B, the second point is Gramsci's interregnum, just understanding the conditions of the present as being mixed between the old kind of co-opting the new, right? And the new cannot be born. So all sorts of strange hybridizations are emerging, right? So this sort of awkward, unbearable tension of the present where we want to help people, we want to imagine a new society, but the conditions of the present really force us to work with the old in a lot of ways to try to transform it. And again, everything that goes with Gramsci is that sort of leftist Marxist, you know, post-capitalist analysis. And then C, the third part would be the whole Gebser Janus faced world, which is very similar to the interregnum, and understanding that these are also conditions of consciousness transformation. But I also throw in Gloria Anzaldúa in there because she's never talked about in the liminal web or any of these circles, right? A Mexican feminist scholar, philosopher, who wrote quite a bit about this. And she uses the word liminality to talk about it. But for her, she describes folks like us as napantlas or napantleras, right? Living in these between times or liminal times. But the way you live in the middle is to work with transforming and guiding the present. You can't just abandon the present for a new type of utopian society. You have to work with the conditions in that bodhisattvic turn towards the present. The only way to get into the future is to actually turn towards the present and the present conditions and work to transform them and yourself, right? Because we're not just guides, we're also trying to guide ourselves through as well and work these dialectics and contradictions in ourselves to this new reality. So yeah, I'm totally with you in that, like, we need to be grounded and present and imminent. And if we're building a bridge, the bridge has to be built between the worlds. It's not just going to be like, I don't know, just jumping to game B in that sense. Like, we're carry all those contradictions in ourselves. So we have to work all that through. And that means we have to work with partisan politics, civic participation. What does the transition look like to help us move into a post-capitalist future, if that's our framework? There's getting from there to from here to there, but we start here. And I don't see that enough, right? Like, I don't see that orientation towards the present enough in a lot of these communities. It's that same kind of rupturing, future-oriented, modernist mythology of time that's being reified, with all of the tragedies that are involved in reifying that. But again, this is, again, me endorsing MIP in terms of a kind of working with the present. Yeah.
Beautiful, beautiful. I love the interconnections made there. And yeah, what was I going to say? I think that I would love for the liminal web to actually be liminal, right? Like, if we're in a time between worlds, I'd like to see more of an embrace of like the Hermes archetype of like kind of, you know, ferrying messages and building bridges, right, between all these, you know, the new world that's, you know, ostensibly emerging and the current one. But I feel like the shadow of all this is what I've been calling dissociative liminal. Like, we're just dissociating from our local situatedness, right, into some kind of hyper abstracted internet world and internet subculture. And there isn't really a groundedness or a, you know, adultification or whatever you want to call it, of like grounding into your reality. And of course, I, you know, everyone I'm, of course, has a day job, and you know, everyone does this to some degree, but I don't see it penetrate into the center of the conversation for these, whenever there's events or get togethers, or I don't see that part of it come through on social media very often, right? So how do we really, you know, integrate into the present, integrate into our situated local context, and really be a liminal, you know, in the liminal, and be a bridge, you know, bridge builder and bridge maker. So yeah.
And I'll just mention that there's an empathetic way we can understand that, because I know, like, when you enter these spaces, you want to escape, you know, there, totally. You want an escape hatch, and it's totally understandable. But I think that only becomes a problem when we imagine, to effectively begin changing the world, that escapism is enough, right? Like, that we have to kind of curb, like, there's a place for that maybe in the socializing and the play and the culture building around, like, identifying against the way things are. But if we reify that too much and get kind of caught up in it in that sort of myopic way, that, like, oh, we're beyond that, you know, as soon as it becomes that, rather than, like, having some more humility about it, like, yeah, you're human. You're gonna want to imagine a different future and have, like, an escape hatch and feel like you can vent here and be in a different society in this little local community, like, totally understandable human impulses to do that. But if you actually want to be a bridge builder, it's not enough to just have that refuge and proclaim the refuge as the new order or the new society, right? Like, there's a lot of hard work, you know, and that requires another level of maturing. And maybe they don't want to hear that. They want to just be like, hey, if you're already on our side, if you're reading this book, then congratulations, you're the leading evolutionary edge and you're game B. It's not that easy. So yeah, worldview humility, I don't know. Epistemic humility, you mentioned that before, but there's some kind of humility element here.
I think it's an identity issue. I almost called meta ideological politics like meta tribal politics or meta communal politics, right? Because it's like, for me, it's like, I've given up my life. I just turned 30 the other day, right? I've given up trying to find a tribe or trying to find a home that I can be 100% on board with. And I interact with many, many different communities, you know, all over the political spectrum, and find a little something in all of them, but never all at the same time, right? I think there are certain individuals like yourself or other close friends I've made from these circles that I would say that in these, you know, individual micro interactions, I feel this is an overwhelming sense of consonance and synergy. That's great. That's wonderful. But in terms of an actual group cultural space, I don't identify with any of them really. And it caused me a lot of grief in my life trying to find the one community that will solve all my problems and be my kind of little utopic bubble. And I've realized now that's never going to happen. So I have to kind of diversify myself, find a little piece of myself everywhere, right? And then that's kind of like, I just accepted, like, that's who I am and that's what I'm about. So like, you know, bursting out of the enclosed, you know, insulated bubble that we tend to get, you know, trapped in our own comfort zones. And then we end up in that, from that kind of social identity structure, we end up reifying these concepts, right? We reify these abstractions and don't get out enough and be more meta-tribal or meta-communal. So I just want to throw that in too. We keep on going and going.
Yeah. So, like, we should definitely do a follow-up. I'm sure there's going to be a lot more discourse around liminal web stuff. So, we can pause that and hold that for next time, but I think it's a good place to pause on. Ironically, for empathy for liminal web folks is this tribal move. I mean, everything you said about the conditions we've been talking about in our present society, deep atomization, lack of a sense of belonging, meaning crisis, totally makes sense. We're gonna be pathologically aggregating towards dysfunctional, myopic, self-inflated communities of, like, heroically self-inflated communities of game B or whatever. So, like, totally get why that's happening. And yet, like, there's a move here, and maybe we could talk about that move next time, like how we can kind of flip that. So, thank you, Ryan. This has been an awesome conversation as always.
Yeah. Thank you, Jeremy. This is a blast to, kind of throw back to the old days. I'll talk to you soon.
Great. Take care.